What did beer taste like in Kansas City 100 years ago? We assigned our intern, Aaron Pelish, the grueling task of finding out.
On a clear fall morning, Charlie Poulter is chopping an armful of firewood at a small farm nestled in between a parking lot and a public tennis court. He's preparing to make a unique type of beer that was popular in the KC area in the 1920s, apple short beer. Charlie says this recipe combines the heritage of Kansas City settlers from Belgium and Germany with the natural resources from local farmland to make a distinctly KC beer.
This short beer would have been something that's relatively easy to produce, using something that's very well tended in Kansas and Missouri in this part, which is apples, and just bringing that culture over from the mother country.
Charlie is the museum director of Shawnee Old Town, a living history museum that recreates what life was like for farmers in Shawnee, Kansas in 1929. He's making short beer over an open fire as part of a museum demonstration. Short beer is made really quickly, unlike most beers. This batch will be fully brewed in just 3 days.
It's basically just apples, yeast, and you cook it down, and in about 3 days it lets off enough gas, then it should be ready.
Traditional short beers usually have less than 2% alcohol in them. In the past, farm families would drink it casually, like how people drink soda or lemonade today.
This is something they would have drank during the day for a refreshment. It's so low alcohol. It's something that women and men and young adults would have had on the farm, definitely in the late 19th century, all through the first half of the 20th century.
Charlie says this batch of short beer will taste like a Dutch apple pie, but he admits anyone expecting the taste of a Budweiser or a hard cider will be a little underwhelmed.
That was KCUR intern Aaron Pelish. He brought us back a little of that apple cider beer, short beer. It came in mysterious packaging and it tasted apple-y. I will refrain from giving it a more thorough review because it's probably best served cold and mine was warm. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and this morning's guest is an expert in the city's beer history, our old drinking buddy, Pete Doolin. Hey, Pete.
Hey, good morning.
So in your last book, KC Ale Trail, you took us on a tour of the local breweries of today. Your new book is Kansas City Beer, A History of Brewing in the Heartland. What was it that gave you an inkling that there might be a whole book in Kansas City's beer history?
Well, there's a lot of history around us, remnants of the prior brewing age, such as Imperial Brewing, the building that's off of I-35 in the west side. That was one of the biggest breweries in the country. And as I started researching a little bit and talking about the concept of the book with the publisher, I realized there was a rich history there.
Continuity between what happened with the Kansas City brewers back in the day, like in the 19th and earlier 20th century, and the microbrewery movement that's taking hold today, like, do you think that exists, that there's a continuous story you can tell there?
Well, I think as far as a timeline, there's certainly gaps, and we can kind of get into that. But I think as far as continuity, more so with craft and just the actual making of the beer, the fundamentals are fairly straightforward as far as the ingredients that you use.
And unchanged.
Right, and how you make beer. But it has evolved as modern brewers have specialized in doing barrel-aged beers and adding new types of hops and experimenting with different styles. And so you have this tradition with innovation that's built on it. And I think that is part of the continuity of the craft from, the 1800s, 1900s, all the way to today.
I was surprised that you began your book with reflections on a Carl Sandburg poem. Probably not a lot of books about beer begin that way.
Yeah, it's, I was wanting to do something a little bit different in thinking about the history of brewing and the city itself, because the history of brewing is embedded in the history of Kansas City. And it just occurred to me as I was reading this poem, which is one of my favorite poems, this image of a family of Hungarians and their friends hanging out by a riverside, playing music, accordion, and having beer on a Sunday afternoon.
And this is sort of the conclusion to a search for happiness.
Yes, yes. And that mental image and just that feeling like really stuck out to me of people gathered together in a social setting, and beer was very much a part of that. And I think that's true wherever people enjoy beer, whether it's at the ball game or at a bar. Yeah.
Do you think that there's something about beer among alcohols that is like kind of an equalizer? Because I was thinking that there are some kinds of drinks that really signify either class or some other distinction between people, age. But it doesn't seem like, I mean, when you get into what kind of beer you're drinking, that might happen. But just beer itself seems to kind of cross a lot of lines.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think if you go back in the history of beer and brewing, once you get out of, you know, home brewers that were just making it for themselves, but when you started making it available to the public, it was very much a working class drink. And it was something that was easy to produce in volume, that was relatively inexpensive, that could be sold at the saloon or tavern. While I don't really talk about this in my book, I remember having a conversation with Chuck Majerle, the founder of Free State Brewing. And
In Lawrence.
And Steve Bratt, and who is the director of brewing operations there. And they were telling me about how breweries would help fund and sponsor lots of infrastructure projects in towns and cities back in the day. And they would pay people in beer. And so you would have schools built or roads built or things that needed to be built in the community. And people would work for beer as part of their payment.
Why did breweries want to initiate these infrastructure projects?
Well, I think it was just, you know, good for the community. And that really carries forward to today, whether it's, you know, Free State's involvement in Lawrence or in Kansas City with Boulevard Brewing being very much a hometown brewery that, you know, they haven't necessarily sponsored the building of bridges and roads, but they're very active in the community because they want to support and help the community that they are part of. And I think that spirit carries through all the way to today's newer breweries.
It took about 20 years after Kansas City was settled for local brewing to like establish itself here. Even though there were lots of little breweries in cities back east, even just as close as St. Louis, it sounds like we were more of a whiskey town.
Yeah, initially that was the drink that was available and abundant. Whiskey was something that, because of the alcohol content, it didn't spoil. And so it could be transported longer distances and
we were kind of like the Wild West at that time.
Oh, absolutely. It's, you know, back in the 1830s to 1850s, it's Kansas City was the edge of the Western frontier. It to me, I always think of Kansas City as the true gateway to the West, because that's where people came to either stay here or move on to the West. And whiskey was very abundant, especially in Westport, which was its own separate community while Kansas City was developing closer to the riverside.
So the fact that whiskey wouldn't go bad was really important just in how remote we were.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, back then you didn't have the established transportation. You know, it was, you know, by horse or wagon train. You didn't have railroads established yet. And so getting those, you know, the spirits from place to place and, you know, into taverns meant providing something that could last and wouldn't spoil.
What can you tell us about Kansas City's original beer pioneers? And I'm going to resist the urge to, like, make that into one word, like beer-ineers or something.
Thank you. well, one of the first brewers in Kansas City that we know on record is Peter Schwitzgabel, who opened a brewery at 3rd and Oak, like a block away from the city market. And He was a German immigrant that set up a brewery that was known as Third Street Brewery and Kansas City Brewery at various times. And it served a very small footprint. And there's not a lot of information because this was around the mid-1850s or so. But he was the first brewer in what became Kansas City. Back then it was the town of Kansas City, and it was the River Market area was the urban center. And so he was providing a service, and he had a market that was gathered there of people that were settling and doing business and trading. Over the next 10, 20 years, he had a number of other breweries that opened up as the city expanded south into what we would think of as the Power and Light District and the Crossroads District today. A lot of these early breweries were kind of mom-and-pop shops. They were very small operations.
Did they serve people on premises?
I think more so they provided beer to local taverns and saloons. I think some of them may have had what we would call tap rooms today, but their primary goal was production and to supply the taverns and saloons that were abundant throughout Kansas City.
The story of Kansas City beer and just like regional beer, I guess, as you tell it, seems to me to have like three chapters: before Prohibition, during Prohibition, and then after Prohibition, but like a lot after Prohibition, as in maybe, starting in 1989.
Right, right.
Can you talk about the pre-Prohibition brewing culture in Kansas City and then how Prohibition changed that, which seems to be a very different story if you're looking at Missouri versus Kansas?
Yeah, absolutely. So Prohibition began, national Prohibition began in 1920. And prior to that, brewing really gained a lot of momentum from like the 1860s all the way to 1920. And these smaller operations started to grow and prosper. And you started to see immigrants and that were opening these businesses become entrepreneurs and open these larger manufacturing operations.
Were immigrants from any particular area heavily involved in Kansas City's brewing scene?
Primarily Germans. You had a lot of Germans that migrated from the East Coast. They settled in St. Louis, and then they continued to drift westward towards Kansas City or the upper Midwest. And the German immigrants were really instrumental in the development of beer, not only locally but nationally, because they brought the techniques and technology to produce lager beer, which quickly became a very popular style, and it still is today. Most of the beer that's produced from mainstream large macro breweries are lagers.
Well, sorry, I interrupted to ask that, but I still want to hear sort of the big picture of pre-Prohibition brewing in our area.
Sure. So in addition to these smaller breweries, you started to see the rise of breweries like Mühlbach Brewing. And so Mühlbach Brewing is one of the better known names throughout Kansas City with the family. But they bought a brewery that was once called Main Street Brewery around 19th and Main, in the Crossroads, kind of near where the Rieger is. And they operated there for a little while and expanded it, and then later moved their operation to around 18th Street near where the Barclay Building is, kind of the TWA Building. And they built a really large operation there. It was kind of the beer castle. And in order to survive, breweries like Mühlbach and the Ferdinand Heim Brewery in the East Bottoms had to really grow in scale and become these larger manufacturing operations to produce in volume and then distribute as widely as they could throughout Kansas City.
And the Mühlbach Brewing Company, they made Pilsner that was you write about it being so popular that, that they didn't distribute it beyond Kansas City?
Yes, it was a beer that was really beloved, and it's one of those German-influenced styles of beer that was really popular, and so popular that everything that they produced was primarily consumed in the city limits.
When we look at Prohibition, I mean, when you tell the story in your book of the Weston Brewing Company in Weston, Missouri, that ended up where it is or was because of an 1887 Supreme Court decision by the Kansas Supreme Court that affirmed the state's right to shut down a brewery. The founder of that brewery actually moved from Salina to open it there, sort of in the wake of that decision. Does a difference between Kansas beer culture and Missouri beer culture persist even today, stemming from different attitudes toward prohibition on opposite sides of the state line?
Well, I think that the lingering effects of prohibition have kind of rippled forward in time. So it's just to go back a bit, in Kansas, they actually enacted a state prohibition law around 1880. And even prior to that, dating back to the 1830s and then another wave in the 1850s, were enacting community laws that prohibited the sale or manufacture of making alcohol. And that was fueled by the temperance movement. Carrie Nation was one of the more famous figures that kind of started to change the climate morally and politically. And so you had this progression in the state leading up to 1880, where there was a less hospitable climate, you know, as a business owner and brewer or winemaker, distiller, to operate there. And so with this state Supreme Court decision that went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, it was determined that, yes, because of on behalf of the health of its state constituents, the state could shut down a brewery and take over that property. And so that really became an unfriendly climate to operate when you're investing all this money in brewing equipment and buildings. And therefore, a lot of manufacturers moved over to the Missouri side.
But of course, when you look at Missouri, Kansas City, Missouri in particular, during the national prohibition, you can't talk about the flow of any kind of alcohol without talking about Tom Pendergast.
Yes, absolutely. It's well known that, you know, during the Pendergast era, there was a lot of alcohol still flowing freely throughout the city. Pendergast had a hand in that indirectly. He was savvy enough to have warehouses and operations where he wasn't directly tied to it. But if you were a maker or distributor of alcohol, beer, and spirits, it flowed freely in Kansas City during the Parish of the Plains era.
And then, you know, it's a little leaping way forward because it seems like the next chapter post-prohibition really doesn't get started until 1989. And it is a little jarring for me, I have to admit, to read about Boulevard Brewery in a history book. But I guess 1989 does qualify as history now.
It does. And I think that's one of the interesting things about this book as I was researching it and writing it, was just kind of being immersed in the events of today and realizing, well, this doesn't feel like, it just feels like current events, but it's history in the making. Even as I was writing the book, shortly before turning in the manuscript, 75th Street announced they were going to close after a 22-year run. And, you know, we can hear that news and kind of, you know, blink, and then it's old news last week. But that's a significant part of Kansas City's brewing history.
What's significant about the 75th Street Brewery?
Well, it was the first brew pub in Kansas City that was in the Waldo area. And in the, you know, along with Boulevard being founded in 1989, you had the 1990s that really kicked off this interest in microbrewed beer, as it was predominantly called then. And you had these brew pub concepts that were popping up in Kansas City as well as in the Kansas side. So you had like the River Market Brewery down in the River Market area, Power Plant, Brew Pub in Parkville, and other places in like the Overland Park area.
That was kind of a trend where they'd have like the tanks on display behind glass.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's still kind of a feature of modern day brew pubs and breweries that have tap rooms. And so 75th Street was one of the first, it was the first actually in Kansas City as a brew pub to take this concept that was already being popularized in Colorado and bring it here. And it mixed this environment where you could see the making of the beer. So there was some transparency there. And then just this wide range of flavors and styles that people weren't used to.
I love all the artifacts you tracked down and photographed for this book. Like, there's a can of Country Club malt liquor from Getz Brewing Company. And it's this very, very basic-looking beer can. I mean, today, design would have a lot more going on this can than was going on. How do you track things like that down? I mean, who keeps an old can of beer handy for the future food writers of our nation?
You'd be surprised. I actually found that can in one of the antique shops in the River Market just as I was kind of kicking around. And but there are actually a lot of collectors of brewery memorabilia and Hometown Beer, which is a book that was published, I think, in 1989, that kind of covers a similar history of brewing in Kansas City up to 1989. They spend a lot of time on brewery Anna, as the proper term is called, the tin plates and the glassware and the bottles. And so there's, if you dig around and if you're interested in collecting or just finding out about those items, there's an abundance of it available.
What do we learn about ourselves as a city when we understand our food and drink history and especially our beer history?
Well, I think it's in, you know, the local movement and, you know, shopping local, supporting local has been kind of in vogue for a little while. But it really just kind of harkens back to a time when really the beer that you drank was made by a local brewer or a farmer.
Pete Doolin, author of Kansas City Beer, A History of Brewing in the Heartland. Let's grab a beer soon.
All right. Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and when KCUR Central Standard returns, how your favorite local musicians cover their healthcare expenses. That's coming up. Stay tuned. Welcome back to KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. When local musician Abigail Henderson was diagnosed with breast cancer, Kansas City's music community came together and helped her pay the huge medical bills that accompanied her diagnosis. That prompted her to start the Midwest Music Foundation, a nonprofit that helps other musicians confronting serious medical situations. Abigail died in 2013, sadly, but the Midwest Music Foundation is still up and running, and its ninth annual benefit show, Apocalypse Meow, is this weekend. Of course, a lot has changed with healthcare in that time, notably the Affordable Care Act. So the rest of today's show is a checkup on the healthcare in Kansas City's music community. If you're a musician or an artist of any kind, call 816-235-2888 to tell us how your access to healthcare has or hasn't changed in the last 2 years, and if you expect it to change again soon. 816-235-2888. Let's start by talking to musician Chris Meck of Chris Meck and the Guilty Birds. Hi, Chris. Thanks for coming in.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
You were a bandmate of Abigail Henderson, but of course, more importantly, you were her husband. Can you tell us the story of her illness from your perspective?
Wow. That's kind of difficult.
I know. I'm sure.
Yeah. She was diagnosed with inflammatory breast cancer in 2008. Which is a rare and very aggressive form. And so her battle lasted 5 years. And then she passed away in 2013. So, yeah, I mean, it was just a really difficult time.
How do you think being a musician and, like, the particular kinds of schedule, lifestyle, money flow that goes along with being a musician affected how her cancer played out?
Well, you know, there's kind of a stereotype of the sort of layabout musician that doesn't really work. And that's really, really inaccurate. Generally, what you have is just a class of working poor. We work in restaurants, bars, jobs that will allow the sort of flexibility in order to be able to play music. But those jobs don't have benefits very often. And they don't tend to be all that high-paying jobs. So what you end up with is a lot of people that are trying to hold it together with a couple of jobs and then trying to squeak the music in as well. So it just makes for a really hectic schedule.
How did that affect the way Abigail was or maybe wasn't able to take care of things when she found out she was sick?
Well, when she got sick, we had to come off the road. We had been touring 120 plus dates a year. We were going to Europe every year, and for longer periods of time each time. And when she got sick, that pretty much all stopped, because between work and care for cancer, and then some, you know, her health would kind of go up and down as far as what she was able to do. So it sort of made you know, touring or keeping a really heavy music schedule had to take a backseat.
There is a long tradition of musicians in Kansas City, and I'm sure elsewhere, but this is the city where I've been and witnessed it. I mean, musicians coming together and putting on benefits for one another when something like this happens, sort of an after-the-fact kind of thing. But do you remember finding out that you guys were going to be recipients of that kind of spontaneous generosity?
Yeah, well, they didn't tell us when they were doing it. It was a secret. We only found out like a few days before the shows. And it turned out to be a really good thing because while Abigail did have health insurance, the health insurance company was trying to deny the claim. So we ended up needing that money to hire a lawyer in order to force the insurance company to make good on their end of the bargain. So it ended up just being something that we desperately needed. And Abigail wanted to put something in place to help somebody else, you know, the next person down the line, because that's just kind of how she was.
Why do you think she was targeting her efforts toward other musicians in particular?
Well, a funny thing had happened to us on tour. We were on tour in the South, and she started having really bad stomach pains. And we were in New Orleans, and somebody said, "Well, why don't you just go to the musician's clinic?" And she was flabbergasted that there was such a thing. And she went to the musician's clinic there in New Orleans, and I think it was like $60 or something to see a doctor. And she found out that she had a herniated diaphragm. So they told her what she needed to do to get through the rest of the tour. And she just couldn't believe that something like that even existed, and really felt like if we could get towards something like that here in Kansas City, that would be a really great thing. So for her, she just wanted to make sure that, you know, we could take steps in that direction.
And so that's how the Midwest Music Foundation was born. And I'm so sorry for making you relive what I can't even imagine. But I mean, has healthcare been an issue for you? You're a musician as well.
Not personally. I'm healthy as a horse. So.
As a healthy horse.
Yeah.
Do you have coverage in case something were to happen to you?
I don't. the Obamacare. It's difficult to talk about it without getting into the politics of it, but in you know, Missouri and Kansas, they voted to not accept the federal funds. So for somebody like me, it's...
For Medicare expansion.
Right. So for somebody like me, it's not become more affordable. So
Does that worry you? Are you able to...
Oh, sure. I know better than most that something can come out of the blue and really be a life-changing thing. So...
Do you get the feeling that a lot of other musicians in town are approaching this issue the way you are? That, I mean, that the affordability is still keeping people from pursuing health coverage?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's still like, as I was saying, it's a working poor situation, basically. I mean, you know, everybody's working, everybody's doing what they can to keep the roof over their heads. And that's difficult enough.
Without an additional
bill
to pay.
So it's a risk.
Well, let's get another perspective from Brandon Phillips. He's with us from a longtime local indie favorite, a band called The Architects. And Brandon, you've had Crohn's disease your whole life.
Yeah. Yes, I have.
So I'm guessing that you probably do not forego health insurance.
I cannot forego health insurance, much as I would like to. Sometimes I can't really go without it. And I had to go without it for a long time before Obamacare, before the ACA. And
so that did change things for you.
It did. Yeah. It took away the pre-existing condition, restrictions. I used to not be able to, I didn't have the option of enrolling in any insurance plan.
How did that work in your life? I mean, explain what Crohn's disease is and how it affects you.
It's an autoimmune disorder that wrecks your intestines, your joints, and your skin, or like all three or one of the three. And it's chronic and it's possibly degenerative and it's ugly. It's a big ugly disease. It's in the same family as like ulcerative colitis and stuff like that. But it's a big ugly hassle. And
without insurance, what did you do when you were really suffering from this disease?
Well, with or without insurance, I have no. If I have an acute episode, I have no choice but to find an emergency room. Whether I'm in Kansas City or Nepal, I have to go find whatever the nearest emergency room is. So that's with or without insurance. With insurance, it's less unaffordable.
Less unaffordable.
Without insurance, without insurance, it's outrageous. And there have been a couple of, had a couple of surgeries and had some, some near miss almost surgeries and stuff like that. And those things are equally unaffordable.
When were you diagnosed?
I was 13.
As someone who has been your entire career as a musician and like the time leading up to that career also, you had this chronic illness that landed you in the emergency room regularly already when you made this choice to pursue music. Mm-hmm. What's unique about the situation of being a chronically ill musician, someone who's dealt with that since you were a teenager?
It's uniquely crappy.
You're traveling all the time.
So. Yeah. So, being a musician means you don't really get a lot of rest and you travel all the time and you deal with, and you cheerfully deal with a lot of very Spartan austerity. And none of that is made easier by having to go to the bathroom 25 times a day and, always needing to know where the nearest hospital is just in case and having to deal with like a 30-pound bag of prescriptions that you have to take with you everywhere. So,
do I understand correctly that anxiety triggers the episodes?
Yeah.
So it seems like the uncertainty of going from one city to the next and of mounting medical bills would not be helpful.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's an absolute spiral, the uncertainty of mounting medical bills, the uncertainty of, is this creep promoter in Indianapolis going to pay us what he said he was going to pay us? Are we going to have enough, do we have enough gas money? Blah, blah, blah. All the stress that comes with running a business out of a van, Yes, that's anxiety, and it doesn't make you any healthier. It doesn't make me any healthier. It makes me considerably less healthy.
You've described this situation as, to quote you, uniquely crappy.
I mean,
have you been tempted to give up music through any of this?
No. If somebody, you know, if a team of doctors amputates my hands and confines me to a wheelchair for the rest of my life, I will still, you know, I might consider giving it up and doing something else, but I'm not giving it up.
Everyone has something in their lives like that. Can you explain what you just expressed a little more? I mean, for people who don't have something that is to them what music is to you.
It's, you know, I don't have kids. I have this. You know, I don't, it's difficult to explain. Most people don't have a job that they would work a second job to work. I don't have kids. I have this. I don't have real estate. I have this. I don't have, all the stuff that people, you know, that people want.
It's who you are.
It's not selves.
It's not something you do. It's who you are. And you can't just not do that.
Yeah, it would be absurd to even try to walk away.
Do you know people who have done that over this issue? Either of you?
Over illness?
Yeah. And over healthcare dilemmas.
I know people who quit in disgust and sulked back to the square world and maybe one of the things they cited as they were kicking rocks by the railroad tracks on their way back to getting a desk job or whatever was like, I'm going to get some benefits. I never had benefits. I want dental or whatever. But,
They tend to come back after a while.
Because
it's so much of a fundamental part of who you are that you're just miserable if you try to deny that. So,
if you're a musician or an artist of any kind with a healthcare story to tell, we want to hear it. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman, Central Standard. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. We're talking about the healthcare of musicians in our area. We just heard from Chris Meck and Brandon Phillips about their experiences fitting healthcare into their lives or not fitting it into their lives. Chris has a clear bill of health, so he takes the risk of going without insurance, even though he hates to do that. And Brandon has Crohn's disease, so he can't take that route quite so easily. He has health insurance for the first time since Obamacare got rid of the pre-existing condition stipulation. We'll get back to them, but Renata Marinaro, Director of Health Services for the Eastern Region of the Actors Guild, is with us now. She's in New York. Hi, Renata.
Hi there.
We spoke right after the Affordable Care Act went into effect. We were looking at that time at how artists were responding to the coverage mandate. A lot of people seemed to be signing up on the health exchanges back then. What have you seen since then?
A tremendous increase in coverage. It's really astonishing. So in 2013, we did a survey with the Future of Music, and we surveyed artists and performers nationwide, and we found that about 53% of people were insured, which is a very low rate. And now it looks like we are over 90% insured. So we've gone from 53% to over 90% in a few years, which is amazing.
And that's within what region again?
The country.
The whole country. 90%. Mm-hmm. So you help people get signed up, right?
Mm-hmm.
What are the biggest or most persistent obstacles for performing artists like musicians who are trying to get signed up for health insurance?
Probably one of the biggest just practical things is that they have trouble estimating their variable income. Like Chris so eloquently said, they are often the working poor, and so they have multiple jobs, multiple sources of income. Some might be self-employed jobs, some might be W-2 jobs, and so they don't really know what deductions they can take, how to estimate their income, and actually they don't even really know what their income's going to be in the next couple months. It's a very insecure life. And it's filled with ups and downs. It's a roller coaster. So we find that people have a hard time understanding their income and estimating it for the application, which means that they may be paying more for insurance than they should, or they may just opt out of the whole thing because it's so frustrating to fill out the application. They say, forget it, and then they end up paying a penalty. The other thing that Chris also said was in 20 states, we don't have Medicaid expansion. And I just want to say, come on, Kansas and Missouri, get it together. We need to have expanded Medicaid in these states. It's been extremely successful in 30 other states. It's one of the main reasons why the coverage rate is so high. And it puts those who have lower incomes in a very awkward position because it's very hard to pay for insurance if you're only making, $12,000 or $13,000 a year.
So do you work with people who are both in states that do have the expansion and states that don't?
Well, in our area, yes, we do. But mainly the states where we work, we are navigators in California and in New York. And most of the Northeast has expanded Medicaid. California has expanded Medicaid. Chicago, we have a lot of people in Chicago. They've expanded Medicaid. So mostly we see people who are receiving expanded Medicaid.
So it sounds like your conclusion from that is that you are seeing musicians and performing artists in general getting really better access to coverage in states that have expanded?
Exactly. That's exactly it. And also, not just that, but they're paying less. So before, the average cost of insurance was much higher, believe it or not. Before the ACA, it was much higher. And now, when you factor in the cost of premiums for what are called qualified health plans, which you can buy on the marketplace, with the cost of Medicaid, which is zero to the participant, the overall premiums have gone down significantly. So we're finding greater access to health insurance, lower cost overall, but I don't want to dispute that the costs are still too high, because they are. I think what Chris mentioned about it being unaffordable is becoming, unfortunately, more and more true as you see companies increasing their rates by 20, 30, and 40% this year. So there is that. But I just want to mention that I think Brandon also had some very important things to say, and they reflect, and we've touched on the cons, but they reflect the pros of this law. And that, is that there are no more pre-existing condition exclusions. So he's able to get coverage. Somebody with a heart murmur is able to get coverage. That's extremely important. I worked for years with cancer patients at a hotline, and they would call because they'd just been diagnosed with cancer, and they didn't have insurance, as many people didn't before the law, and they were never going to get insurance because no insurance company was going to insure them, and they couldn't afford the cost of treatment. So you're talking about people who died because they didn't have insurance. So the risk of that is much, much lower now, and also, coverage is more comprehensive. So before, I remember in 2013, I had a dancer in one of my seminars who said, I have insurance for my arms and my legs.
Like, she insured those body parts?
That was all the insurance she could get. So she had insurance for her arms and her legs. There's a lot of other important parts of your body that move your arms and your legs, and those weren't insured. And that can't happen anymore. So the coverage.
So she was insuring like her income generating parts of her body.
Yeah, right. But also before the law, there were a lot of insurance policies that didn't cover maternity costs. So most of the women in this country actually were not covered for maternity, even though they were insured. So that can't happen anymore. So coverage is extremely comprehensive, which means that you're not going to worry about whether the ER is covered, whether the drugs, well, you have to worry a little bit about whether the drugs are covered. But there are major categories of health care that are covered now, and that's extremely important.
Getting back to the artistic piece of this, I mean, the artistic life and it's specifically the touring musician's life, which we just heard described, moving in a van, sleeping in Spartan conditions. Mm-hmm. unpredictable income, all of these kinds of things, but also late nights, long hours, being on your feet, exposure to lots of loud noise. I mean, are there specific health issues that frequently come with that life?
Oh, yes. So particularly with musicians, and I say this with a lot of love, but particularly with musicians, there's substance abuse issues, there's mental health issues, there's hearing issues. So, you know, I know my hearing is going from standing next to the speakers at shows when I was younger. So, you know, there's hearing issues, there's carpal tunnel issues from playing, from repeated use. So there's all kinds of physical issues and mental health issues that come into play.
Can coverage, like healthcare coverage, make the difference between whether someone is able to continue being a musician or maybe has to stop? I mean, when you talk about carpal tunnel, that seems like something that untreated could make it just physically impossible to continue executing those repeated movements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if, I can't remember if it was Chris or Brandon who said, you know, maybe if you cut off my hands, I'll stop playing. But I mean, I think it depends on the musician. But definitely, you know, you can have physical issues that greatly impact your ability to generate income because your body is your instrument. Whether you're a musician or a dancer or an actor, your body is your instrument. Your voice might be your instrument. Your arms and legs might be your instrument. So if those things, if you have problems with those things, that's going to impact your ability to make money.
Looking forward, what are some things you expect to see changing, especially for the musician and artist population in the next months and years? I mean, we've talked about that there's very real talk about premium hikes, for example.
I think that more states will expand Medicaid because financially it's in their best interest. So I see greater access to coverage for musicians over time. I think that there are stressors on the system. Medical costs will continue to rise unless the government does something about it. So the EpiPens and the Hep C vaccines and those kinds of things, or treatments, those kinds of things that are dramatically raising the cost of premiums need to be addressed. And if those things aren't addressed, insurance will continue to get more expensive. You know, there are ways for people to participate in this process. I don't want people to think that it's hopeless, because it's definitely not. I always encourage everybody to contact their committee on insurance. So Google Committee on Insurance, Missouri House of Reps, because they are the ones that make the decisions for your state exchange. They are in part responsible for not expanding Medicaid. Those are the people that you want to contact and say, look, I bring money to your state. I am a musician. People come see me in Kansas City, you know. I want to be heard. These are important things that we need in order to continue to be successful in our creative lives. And there's also Families USA, which has a health action network, and that's a nationwide thing. And you can sign up for updates and, you know, join petitions and stuff like that.
I've got to jump in. Chris Meck, I mean, this weekend is Apocalypse Meow, the annual fundraiser for the Midwest Music Foundation. What role does that continue to fill? I mean, do you still see the same level of need in Kansas City for musicians to have their fellow musicians support their healthcare coverage?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think last year we gave out over $20,000 in healthcare grants to musicians here in KC. And this year, we're on a pace to do more than that, I think. So this is our biggest fundraiser of the year. So we get a lot of our stockpile from this week. So,
well, our time is up for today's show. Chris Meck of Chris Meck and the Guilty Birds, thanks so much.
You bet.
And that Apocalypse Meow event is this Saturday at the Record Bar, primarily, a little bit at Mills Record Company. But you can find information about that online. Brandon Phillips of The Architects, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And Renata Marinero has joined us from the Eastern region of the Actors Fund, where she helps performing artists get signed up for health insurance. You can listen back to this discussion later today at kcur.org www.cbs.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, the founder of the Black Lives Matter movement will be in Kansas City, and we will talk about whether that movement represents a generational rift in Black activism. That's tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Andrea Tudhope, and Jen Chen, with help from interns Raven Brooks and Aaron Pelish. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.